Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Settlement Fees and Services Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 24, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Freeman v. Quicken Loans, Incorporated. This case involves a section of the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act stating that, quote, no person shall give and no person shall accept any portion, split, or percentage of any charge made or received for the rendering of a real estate settlement service in connection with a transaction involving a federally related mortgage loan other than for services actually performed, end quote. The question here was whether this prohibition extends to undivided fees that lenders sometimes charge to borrowers at the closing of a mortgage transaction. In an opinion delivered by Justice Scalia, the court held unanimously that, for a plaintiff to establish a violation of the prohibition in question, he or she must demonstrate that the charges for settlement services were divided between two or more persons. To discuss the case, we have Andrew Morris, who is a professor of law at the University of Alabama School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Morris.
Hi, this is Andy Morris at the University of Alabama, and I'm going to talk about Freeman v. Quicken Loans, Inc., a May 24, 2012 decision of the Supreme Court. This case started as lawsuits filed by three couples who got mortgages from Quicken Loans in Louisiana. Two of the couples were charged loan discount fees, and one was charged a loan processing fee and a loan origination fee. There was some confusion in the record about exactly what some of these fees were. Resolving that uncertainty was unnecessary for determining the legal questions in the case. The three couples paid fees that totaled between $980 and $5,675, so a substantial amount of money was at stake. The couples sued Quicken, alleging violation of the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, or RESPA, a 1974 federal statute that regulates the market for real estate settlement services. Under the statute, they could have obtained treble damages for any fees found in violation of the statute. The case ended up in federal court, where the district court granted summary judgment for the defendants, finding that there was no violation of the statute for reasons I'll describe in a minute. A divided panel of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court with a dissent by Judge Patrick Higginbotham. That dissent is worth noting, since Judge Higginbotham is a leading conservative judge, one who is often mentioned as a possible Supreme Court nominee under previous Republican presidents. The Supreme Court unanimously agreed with the Fifth Circuit majority, however, in an opinion by Justice Scalia. The case is interesting for three reasons. First, it settled a question on which the federal appeals courts had divided. The Fourth, Seventh, and Eighth Circuits had all found that a violation required showing a division of a fee. The Second, Third, and Eleventh Circuits had found that a single entity could violate the section by charging an unearned fee. Now we know the answer to that question, and anyone involved in the real estate industry or the mortgage industry will be interested in the result. Second, the case is interesting because it shows the court's conservative and liberal wings united on an issue of statutory interpretation, one resolved by paying careful attention to the words of the statute. This is a careful, lawyerly opinion, and it's nice to see the court unanimously agreeing in such a case. It would be nicer if they could manage it in big, controversial cases, too, but it's good they can do it in narrow, uncontroversial ones, even if it proves harder in the major cases. Third, Scalia's opinion rejects an effort by the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to gain so-called Chevron deference for its views, reading the statute in an expansive way. Chevron USA versus NRDC, a 1984 Supreme Court opinion, was initially thought to herald a new era in deference to administrative agencies in interpreting ambiguous statutes. As it has turned out, the courts still feel free to be skeptical about agency claims about the law when the court doesn't want to defer. This is further evidence that the court is not going to cede legal issues to administrative agencies, and that's good news for fans of limited government. So first, let's talk about the legal issue. The legal issue in this case was a relatively straightforward one. RESPA provides in Section 2607B that, quote, no person shall give and no person shall accept any portion, split, or percentage of any charge made or received for the rendering of a real estate settlement service in connection with a transaction involving a federally related mortgage loan other than for services actually performed. This provision and another that prohibits kickbacks in mortgage transactions are enforced through civil suits brought by consumers or by state attorneys general. The legal issue in this case was whether 2607B prohibited collection of an unearned charge by a single settlement service provider, or whether it prohibited only the sharing of such a charge where at least one of the recipients did not provide a service. RESPA, as a statute, is not a model of clarity, but 2607B's language provides two clues to Congress's intent on this issue. First, the statute says, quote, no person shall give and no person shall accept, unquote. This suggests that the prohibited conduct involves two parties, one giving and one accepting. Second, the statute refers to, quote, any portion, split, or percentage, unquote, of the charges. Well, one can, and the petitioners did, argue that a portion can be the entire portion and that a percentage can be 100%, a split is less than all of something. And Justice Scalia read the statutory language in exactly that way in his opinion. He noted that the shall give, shall accept language implies that the transaction must involve a two-stage process of charging a fee and then dividing it. The petitioners tried to avoid this construction by contending that the consumer gave the fee and Quicken accepted it, but Scalia rejected this as illogical since it would make the consumer liable to him or herself for violating the statute. And this was a point that came up a great deal in the oral argument in this case, and one in which the petitioners and the United States, which was participating as an amicus curiae, struggled with then. In response to a question from Justice Breyer about why their interpretation did not mean that the consumer was also in violation of the Act when he or she paid a fee for a non-service, for example, the petitioner's counsel and the government's counsel both attempted to say that the consumer was actually paying for a service, he or she was just not receiving it. The oral argument transcripts make clear that the justices had a very hard time understanding this argument, which is not surprising because it doesn't make any sense. Scalia also focused heavily on the portion, split, or percentage phrasing, finding that when Congress uses a collection of words like this, Congress is seeking to invoke what he referred to as the common core of meaning of the collection of words. He found that the natural connotation of the three words was less than the whole. As a result, the court held that a violation of 2607B requires the plaintiff to show that a charge for settlement services was divided among two or more persons. Given that four circuits had come out one way and three had come out the other before this opinion, the court might have come down either way on this. It opted for the simplest reading of the statute, and limited government fans should applaud that. The second issue is the role of deference in this. The petitioners argued that the court should defer to a policy statement issued in 2001 by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which administered RESPA at that time. Since then, the Dodd-Frank law has shifted the law to the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, and that agency adopted HUD's previous policy statements and regulations. HUD, and now the Bureau, specifically claimed authority over transactions that did not involve a split between two persons or entities, and over transactions where the fee, quote, exceeds the reasonable value, unquote, of the services. This was an extraordinarily broad claim by HUD and the Bureau, and even the petitioners did not fully adopt it. The statute is not a broad price regulation statute, and HUD and the Bureau clearly overstepped their authority in asserting that it was. The problem for the petitioners was that they needed to disclaim this claim of authority over all overcharges while sheltering under the claim that the statute applied even where there was no division of the fee. That proved impossible, since all the reasons one might defer to an agency are undercut when that agency makes such a blatant misreading of the statute in an effort to expand its own authority. The Chevron deference analysis in general has two steps. The first is a determination of whether congressional intent is clear and unambiguously expressed, and the second is to ask whether the agency's interpretation is reasonable in light of the underlying law. Before one gets to those questions, however, there is the so-called step zero, which was first identified by Professors Thomas Merrill and Kristen Hickman in an influential 2001 Georgetown Law Journal article entitled Chevron's Domain. Step zero asked whether the Chevron framework applies at all. In this case, the court decided it did not, based on its reading of the statutory language as unambiguously requiring a division of the fee. That wasn't a particularly controversial application of the Step Zero framework, and the court's use of it here does not signal any change. Rather, the court's refusal to defer and insistence on its primacy in interpreting statutory language using normal canons of interpretation and the ordinary usage of words is exactly the sort of thing courts ought to do. It's refreshing to find the Supreme Court taking its responsibility to police agency interpretations of statutes seriously, and even more refreshing to find it limiting power grabs by agencies. Finally, let's look at the interest groups that wanted to participate in the case. As you would expect, the real estate and banking industries filed amici briefs, three in total, on behalf of Quicken Loans. These briefs did not add a great deal. They elaborated on the argument that RESPA was not intended to serve as a price control statute or a comprehensive regulation of real estate settlements. If the court had adopted the reading of RESPA proposed by either the government or the petitioners, it would have made the statute much more like a comprehensive regulatory regime, and so these briefs were arguably useful. The United States also appeared as an amicus, and its brief argued for deference to the agency's interpretive policy statement and regulations. As I noted earlier, the government's argument was extraordinarily weak, and the court paid it scant attention in its opinion. Like a street hustler running a shell game, the government waved its hands around a great deal in an effort to distract the court from the statute's language. The government's brief focused primarily on the deference question, and it didn't work. In addition, 20 states and the District of Columbia filed a joint brief in support of the petitioners. There's no obvious link between the states involved. They're a mix of red and blue states from California and Illinois to Wyoming and Idaho. Presumably, the states like the authority they have under the statute, including a 3-year statute of limitations compared to the 1-year statute of limitations for individuals that allows them to bring suits and threaten businesses with a treble damages provision. They argued that curtailing unearned fees was essential to a functioning real estate market and that real estate markets cannot self-regulate because of the, quote, complex and asymmetrical nature of mortgage settlement transactions, unquote. This argument got no traction at all with the court, quite properly, I think, since it was an argument about what sort of statute Congress ought to have passed in 1974, rather than an argument about what sort of statute Congress actually passed. It's encouraging to find a 9-0 Supreme Court not listening to these types of policy arguments in statutory interpretation cases. It would be even more encouraging if state attorney generals stopped wasting taxpayer money trying to lobby the Supreme Court or get themselves on television by filing such briefs. So to sum up, we have a quite straightforward, short opinion from a unanimous court. It takes a question of statutory interpretation head-on, applies standard principles of statutory construction, and comes up with a clear answer. Unfortunately, that makes this more of an unusual Supreme Court opinion than it should be. The immediate RESPA question is one that needed to be settled, and now it is. The broader implications of the opinion rest on its refusal to defer to the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, where that agency's interpretation went beyond the language of the statute. If this is a signal on other regulation interpretation questions, it's a signal that the court takes its role as the interpreter of statutes quite seriously and will not let agencies read words out of statutes to expand their authority. And it was nice that the court ignored the weak arguments by the 20 states and D.C. and the Solicitor General. Court's job is to read the statutes as they are, not as regulators wish they were. The Supreme Court doesn't always remember that, so it's good that it manages to do so from time to time. This opinion is not likely to wind up in any law school casebooks outside of real estate transaction courses. It breaks no new ground, and it doesn't do anything radical. What it does provide is a reminder of how courts ought to behave in a system of limited government.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.